Baba's Mahasamadhi Satsang is next week, and that's a special one. That's Baba Muktananda Swamiji's guru, and that satsang every year in October is always a special one. So tune in next week, next Saturday, for that one. And we're also really excited to announce the online retreat. It's the first time we've kind of done anything like this. The retreat kind of really designed for like online people to really experience the retreat Shakti and know what it's like. The retreat's called Love Yourself, Love the Divine. And it's from October 22nd to October 25th. So it's a Thursday night to a Sunday. And you can register at satsanglive.com.au, which is obviously the website you're looking at. But if you go to the homepage, it's really clear and you'll see it.
Okay, next we're going to do 54 goddess mantras. And these are different bija mantras or seed mantras of different forms of the goddess. And they're Om Aim Rim Klim.
Om Aim Rim Klim.
Krim Shrim Dum.
Krim Shrim Dum.
Parashaktye Namaha. And these powerful mantras are getting rid of ignorance all over the planet and fighting against the virus and freeing people from tyranny everywhere. And so let's do 54 of them for the good of everyone in the satsang and everyone in the world. We'll begin with Gajanam.
Om Aim Rim Klim Klim Shrim Dum Parashaktye Namaha.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome to everyone watching around the world on the Global Satsang. And I want to greet now the kids who are watching in Radio Land. I want to say hello to Sammy and Vaishnavi and Santoshi and Josh, watching around in the neighborhood, Harvey and Ocean and Leo, and then up in Melbourne, Liam and Finley, and in Byron Bay, Rafi and Amalia. So welcome to Satsang, kids. Now go to bed. No? You can listen to my boring talk now. So I always like to welcome everyone as my guru, Baba Muktananda, welcome everyone. He used to always begin his programs by saying in Hindi, Sabko Barisan Mani Kesat Premse Hardik Swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And for him, that was the essence of spirituality. And in that spirit, I always want these programs to be conducted, and I want to welcome you in that spirit. And if we can welcome another person and welcome ourselves, there's very little left to do spiritually. Now, I've been reading recently from a book of poems that Baba did. Very nice, they're short poems, but on spiritual topics. There are hundreds of these little poems in the book called Reflections of the Self. A few of them tonight have a particular point of view. It's as though Baba is speaking directly to each of us, but he's not addressing us as our individual egos or our personalities, but is addressing us as we are in truth, as the self, as spirit. So he's talking to us in that way. And if you listen to it and realize that the guru is speaking to me, but he's speaking to the part of me that is Brahman, that is the essence, that is the absolute, that is the divine in me. And let that those words go right to that place, because there is that place within every one of us. They call it by different names, the soul. We like to call it the Atman or the Self. So here's one. Baba says, talking to you and me and all of us, you are the Self, pure, indestructible, eternal. You are the Self, non-dual, all-pervasive, unchanging, unborn. No ignorance can be found in you. You are as constant as the North Star. The young kids might not know that in the old days, navigators guided themselves by the North Star because you could always find the North Star. Now they've got many more sophisticated GPS and things like that. Those in the days we actually did things like long division and things like that before all these devices. Another one. You are free of attachments and Maya. You might say, I'm full of attachments and Maya. At least all my friends are. But there's a place inside each of us where we are that freedom. You are free of attachments and Maya and devoid of all sins. You are the ancient tankless one. You are the absolute Brahman, the Self. Wonderful word, Brahman, which appears in the Upanishads, and it's the word they give to the absolute, which means absolute consciousness. Satchitananda, consciousness absolute, bliss absolute, beingness absolute, Brahman. It's the impersonal consciousness, just as each of us knows our personal consciousness. Yet when we go to sleep at night in deep sleep, we come close to that Brahman, that impersonal consciousness. Because when we are in deep sleep, we're no longer a person. We are close to the absolute. He says, you are the Brahman, the self. Your mind is perfectly still. You are bliss. You are another one. You are intelligent, pure, and free, full of joy and peace. You are the indivisible self. You are the transcendental state and the space between the eyebrows. You are the all-pervasive, eternal God. You are massive, ancient, strong, and true. These are wonderful words to contemplate. I am massive, ancient, strong, and true. Very different. Great contrast between our usual whinging selves. Self-pitying, whinging, that self. It's not who Baba's talking to. Behind that is the true self. You are the witness of all. So, reflections of the self. So tonight, it gives me a lot of pleasure. One of my favorite sages, the first one that I came in touch with at the beginning of my search before I ever went to India, and he's this adorable gentleman, George Gurdjieff. And he was a trailblazer and a forerunner, a great spiritual teacher, who manifested in the West years before there was a real Western surge of spirituality. 50 years before that, in the 1920s, Gurdjieff came to Europe and came to America, and he began teaching and giving his extraordinary teachings, some of which you'll hear tonight. And he was from East, from Eastern Turkey, from Greek and Armenian background. And he had a student who was a Russian mathematician and philosopher named Uspensky. And there he is, very solid and intellectual. And we're very grateful to Uspensky because Uspensky had a really tremendous grasp of Gurdjieff's ideas, and he wrote a great book. Gurdjieff himself was an inspired teacher and sage, but he wasn't much of a writer. And it was left to Uspensky to put it all together so that people could understand what Gurdjieff was talking about. He wrote a great book called In Search of the Miraculous, which is one of the most popular spiritual books and full of profundity and mystery too. So these are some things from Uspensky. Now, Girish was just talking about the headless one. By the way, the headless one is an idea from an old friend of mine who's passed away long ago, Douglas Harding, who was an English architect. And he discovered the headless one time in India, walking in the Himalayas. And he had he had a spiritual experience. And in that spiritual experience, his perception was, because he looked out on this great vista of the mountains and massive space, and he suddenly realized that he wasn't a small person in this vastness. All of it was inside of his head. And he actually didn't have a head, but this vastness was on his shoulders. Because from your perspective, whatever you see is inside is your head, actually. Like Girish could see his head from behind from the drone, but none of us have ever seen the back of our own heads. I've often talked about that. It's a remarkable thing that everybody else can see the back of your head, but you can never see it directly. You can see a photograph, you can see it in the mirror, but you can't see the back of your own head. Isn't that extraordinary? And it's only just there. So when you become headless, then your ego dissolves and you become the witness of everything. And what you do in that state is you self-remember. You remember yourself. And the essence of Gurdjieff's teaching was what he called self-remembering. Baba calls it self-remembering too. Remember the self, Baba would say. Know the self. Hold on to the self. Bhagavan Nityananda said, Bhavana Rakho, which means hold the self. Hold the experience of the self, the one that Baba was talking about there. You are that Brahman. So that refers to an actual spiritual experience that we have. And it says, hold on to that. This is self-remembering. Sometimes it was described as a two-way arrow, that usually our attention just goes out. But Gurdjieff said, self-remembering is when the attention goes out, but at the same time it goes in. You remember that you're there. Very eerily reminiscent of the way Baba described the Bhairavi Mudra that he said Bhagavan Nityananda was always in, where the eyes were open and the attention was always inside. The awareness was both outside and inside at the same time. So here's an amusing bit about self-remembering. Gurdjieff, but at this time, Gurdjieff was in Russia, in St. Petersburg. This is where Uspensky met him, around 1914, somewhere around the First World War, sometime in there. And there was a little group gathered, and Gurdjieff told them to observe themselves. And then try to remember yourself. And he wanted them to see that they did not remember themselves. Uspensky made efforts, being a good student, to remember himself. And remember, this is the practice. So Gurdjieff's system would only be philosophy if it didn't have a practice. It would only be a series of ideas. But any yogic system has to have a practice which actually transforms awareness. Otherwise, it's just another intellectual construct. But self-remembering was the source, at the center of Gurdjieff's system. So Uspensky writes, sometimes self-remembering was not successful. At other times, it was accompanied by curious observations. And I did experiments like this too, by the way. He says, I was once walking along the Liteyny towards the Nevsky. By the way, if you're Russian and I mispronounce these words, you'll have to forgive me. But this is in St. Petersburg. And the Nevsky and the Liteyny are streets, big broad avenues in St. Petersburg near the river. So I was walking along the Liteyny towards the Nevsky, and in spite of all my efforts, I was unable to keep my attention on self-remembering. I was walking along. I used to go down to Konkol when I was studying with Haridas. I used to practice self-remembering in the morning when I went to get the milk. I would try practicing self-remembering on that. He says, the noise, the movement, everything distracted me. Every minute I lost the thread of attention, found it again, and then lost it again. So you have to be very awake to remember yourself. You can't be lost in fantasy, memories, daydreams, worries, because that takes you away from being present and remembering yourself. At last I felt a kind of ridiculous irritation with myself, and I turned into the street on the left, having firmly decided to keep my attention on the fact that I would remember myself at least for some time, at any rate, until I reach the following street. So it's a side street, so it's quieter, right? I reached the Nadejinskaya, another street, without losing the thread of attention, except perhaps for short moments. So he was successful on this street. Then I again turned towards the Nevsky. So he goes, he's in a side street, and that's okay. Then he's back on one of the avenues towards the Nevsky. Realizing that in quiet streets it was easier for me not to lose the line of thought, and wishing therefore to test myself in more noisy streets. Some yogis would say, I should stay on quiet streets and remember myself. But he wanted to test himself. Here we'll see the result of that. I reached the Nevsky, still remembering myself, and was already beginning to experience the strange emotional state of inner peace and confidence which comes after great efforts of this kind. We would call it an experience of Shakti. When your attention is present and not daydreaming, there's a definite experience of inner energy that happens. Gurdjieff himself used to say that certain chemical changes would happen, and it's true that this is what happens. So if you remember yourself and you stay present for a long time, you feel physiological, psychological, spiritual movements inside, and that's what's happening. Just around the corner on the Nevsky was a tobacconist shop where they made my cigarettes. Still remembering myself, I thought I'd call there and order some cigarettes. 2 hours later, I woke up in the Tavritskaya, that is, far away. He woke up suddenly. I was going by cab to the printers. The sensation of awakening was extraordinarily vivid. I can almost say that I came to. I remembered everything at once. I'd been walking along the Nadejinskaya, how I'd been remembering myself, how I thought about cigarettes, and how, at this thought, I seemed all at once to fall and disappear into a deep sleep. He forgot what he was doing. He got lost in his brain, in his mind. Can you relate to that? At the same time, while immersed in this sleep, I'd continue to perform consistent and expedient actions. I left the tobacconist, called at my flat in the Litany, telephoned to the printers. I wrote 2 letters. Then again, I went out of the house. I walked on the left side of the Nevsky up to the Gostinoy Dvor, intending to go to the Ofitskaya. Then I changed my mind as it was getting late. I had taken a cab and was driving to the Kavalergadskaya, to my printers. And on the way, while driving along the Tavritskaya, I began to feel a strange uneasiness, as though I had forgotten something. And suddenly I remembered that I'd forgotten to remember myself. Isn't this a wonderful passage? I spoke of my observations and deductions to the people in our group, as well as to my various literary friends and others. I told them that this was the center of gravity of the whole system, which is a very good understanding, and of all the work on oneself, that now work on oneself was not only empty words, but a real fact full of significance, thanks to which psychology becomes an exact and at the same time a practical science. So what did he discover? He discovered sadhana. It made a big impact on me when I discovered there was such a thing as sadhana. Not just thinking, not just creating systems, not just comparing ideas, but transformation through practice. I said that European and Western psychology in general had overlooked a fact of tremendous importance, namely that we do not remember ourselves, that we live and act and reason in deep sleep, not metaphorically, but in absolute reality. we're actually asleep, because we're lost in mind and in mundane things. And also at the same time, we can remember ourselves if we make sufficient efforts that we can awaken. I was struck by the difference between the understanding of the people who belong to our groups and that of the people outside of them, the people who hadn't practiced. The people who belonged to our groups understood, though not all at once, that we'd come into contact with a miracle, and that it was something new, something that had never existed anywhere before. Well, of course it had existed, but for them it hadn't. It was a new thing, the idea of self-transformation, of sadhana, spirituality. The other people who had not practiced, who did not understand this, they took it all too lightly, and sometimes they even began to prove to me that such theories had existed before. It sounds like this idea and that, but they hadn't actually done the work. So that's a little bit from In Search of the Miraculous about the sadhana they did. Got a couple of question answers with Uspensky on one of the best things that he does, which is talk about negative emotions. The thing that stops us from, well, there are a lot of things that stop us from remembering ourselves. Negative emotions is in the first place. When negative emotions exist, self-remembering is impossible. Question, could you summarize again your teaching about negative emotions? Uspensky says, okay, first of all, it must be your own effort. And next, you must study your negative emotions and classify them. So he always says, Gurdjieff always said, the first process is to study yourself. When, you know, your anger comes up, your fear comes up, your despair comes up, your anxiety comes up. For a yogi, that's great. That's great. You observe it. You see how it works. When does it come up? What is it like? How does it affect you? We should know ourselves very, very well. Well, the more we understand it, then eventually we'll be able to do something about it. You must find which negative emotions you chiefly have, why they come, what brings them on, and so on. If I asked you, do you have more anxiety, despair, anger? Would you know what the answer to that, which you have more of? Okay. You must understand that your only control over emotions is by mind, but this is not immediate. If you think rightly for 6 months, then it will affect negative emotions. If you begin to think rightly today, it will not change your negative emotions tomorrow. He's saying that right understanding is the key, that negative emotions come because we don't truly understand. As Baba was pointing to the place in us that's the self, well, the reason we don't access it, of course, is our understanding is not there. We don't understand that we are that self. He goes on, one of the methods of controlling emotions is through the understanding, through the intellectual center. Attitudes must be created, not at the moment of emotional explosion, but long beforehand. Then little by little, emotional explosions will come under the control of the intellect. Must have right understanding, right attitudes. Thoughts can be more permanent than feelings. And in that way, thoughts can influence feelings. Feelings come and go like lightning, but understanding abides. You can create permanent thoughts, permanent attitudes, which will affect feelings in time. Thoughts like G statements, like I am the self, I am consciousness. All those great thoughts, when we start to assimilate them into our being, it shifts the center of gravity within us, and then we're not afflicted as much by negative emotions. But before this can become possible, a certain discipline must be introduced into our emotions, and a certain knowledge must be acquired in order to work on the emotional mind. Question: isn't the negative emotion of fear sometimes useful? Otherwise, people would cross the road at any time without looking. Ms. Bensky, you speak about instinctive fear. Emotional fear is different. It is based on imagination. That's a very interesting distinction. The fear that keeps you from putting your hand in a fire, that's instinctive fear. That's okay. But neurotic fear is, if I walk there, something will get me or something. Those things are based on imagination. One more before I have something delightful. Do you like this?
Yeah.
I think it's very brilliant. In terms of spiritual psychology, no one beats Gurdjieff. Brilliant kind of Western window into the psychology of the emotions and the mind. Question: do negative emotions have a harmful effect on other functions? Ms. Bensky, you can answer this question by simply observing yourself. For instance, if you're agitated or irritated or something like that, notice some things. Can you remember well? Can you think well? Work well? You'll see that all your faculties are diminished. This observation will by itself show you many other things to observe. This is something we should really understand. If we're in the having a tantrum, an emotional fit, negative fit, we're not at all at our best. We're much diminished. We can't think straight. We can't act properly, and so on. So when we fall a prey to negative emotions, we are not giving ourselves our best shot. We're becoming much less than we actually can be. He goes on. Negative emotions affects all the centers. It affects not only the emotional center, but also the intellectual and moving centers as well. We would call it the vital center. Centers are so connected that you cannot have a strong or violent negative emotion without affecting all the centers. You cannot have a negative emotion and at the same time do something else right or even think rightly. You eat wrongly, breathe wrongly, walk wrongly, work wrongly, everything. You must realize that negative emotions impede spiritual development, because development means development of all there is in man. He's saying, as Baba was saying, there's so much more greatness within us. So much greatness. All these teachings are only to get to the greatness within us. And because of these negative tendencies, we stop ourselves from being everything that we can be. So he says, negative emotions cannot develop. This is a very interesting way of saying here. It would be very dangerous if they could. Say, if you want to develop as a person, you have to get rid of negative emotions, because negative emotions don't develop. A tantrum of a two-year-old is the same tantrum that person has when he's an important banker at the age of 60. When he has a tantrum, it's just like a two-year-old tantrum. It's not a developed, sophisticated tantrum. It's a two-year-old tantrum. So they can't develop. They can't grow. And they impede growth. That an extraordinary thought. Well, my tantrums are quite sophisticated. My paranoia is a highly sophisticated paranoia. So he's saying it would be very disastrous if they could develop, then they would become like atomic bombs. Imagine if your tantrum after you were a mature adult was infinitely stronger than the two-year-old tantrum. That'd be terrible. So if one is trying to create consciousness, one must at the same time struggle with negative emotions. For either you keep them, or if you want to develop, you diminish them. Do not act out of negative emotions. In every action, there is a seed. There is a feeling behind every movement that we make, a thought and a feeling. And that seed is manifested in what we do. And if the seed is anger, fear, or despair, the fruit will be the same. As the seed, so the fruit. So we have to be very careful. That's why he says don't express negative emotions, because they'll have bad fruit. So instead, work with them inside. And when you're in a good space, then from that good space, you can create beautiful things. If one is trying to create consciousness, one must struggle with negative emotions. You cannot hold on to your negative emotions and expect to develop spiritually at the same time. Well, there you go. Nice? Okay, now this is for fun. One of Gurdjieff's writers, a person who wrote about him, I guess a follower of him, was a man named Fritz Peters, who wrote beautifully. And he spent a couple of years with Gurdjieff when he was a little kid, about 12. And then he wrote a wonderful book I heartily recommend if you can get a hold of it, Boyhood with Gurdjieff. It gives a really beautiful, intimate portrait of how Gurdjieff was. And a study of the way his spiritual work was. So this is a story of from that book, from Fritz Peters. This is Fritz. There he is, about the time that he was with Gurdjieff. Do you say in Australia that a thing is on the fritz? Yeah, you do? Okay. What? You do, you don't?
From American TV, I do.
From American TV. It means it's broken or something. That's not from Fritz Peters. Anyway, at some point in the 1920s, Gurdjieff went to the United States, and he brought a big group with him. In those days, they would have to sail. They sailed an ocean liner, you know, to demonstrate his dancing. He had extraordinary dancing. And for that, he incurred a lot of expenses. And plus, he had his ashram in near Paris called the Prieuré, which was very expensive. So he had to support that, plus light and gas and coal bills and food. So he had a high overhead. And for that reason, he had to raise a lot of money in America. And when he got back, he joked about the Americans. He says they were naive but generous. They loved new philosophies and theories. And they had itchy fingers to give him the green stuff in their pockets. So he found them very funny, but he generally liked them. And he came back quite wealthy. He managed to achieve that. And the first thing he did when he got back was to buy bicycles for everyone. And they had bicycles in the place, and it caused great chaos because they didn't know how to ride them, and it was a mess. That's another story. Next thing he did, he had them redo the lawn, which created more confusion. And this is from Fritz. Fritz says, every available tool was put to use, and the lawns were littered with people digging up the grass, rake, raking, reseeding, and rolling the new seed into the ground with heavy iron rollers. Don't forget, his followers are mainly middle-aged intellectuals, you know, who'd never done anything practical in their lives. So he had them all doing this. People worked so closely together that it sometimes seemed as if there was barely room for them all. During this activity, Gurdjieff would march up and down among all the workers, criticizing them individually, goading them on, and helping to contribute a feeling of furious, senseless activity to the whole proceedings. As one of the more recent American students remarked, surveying this ant-like activity, it was as if the entire student body, and perhaps particularly Gurdjieff, had at least temporarily taken leave of their senses. So it's real chaos. Because Gurdjieff wasn't focused on lawn. Gurdjieff was focused on their growth. So before I tell the rest of the story, I have to set the scene at the priory and tell you a bit about one resident, a Russian called Rakhmilovich. So living at the priory at the time was a group of older people, mostly Russians, who didn't seem to be students like the rest of the people. They didn't seem interested in Gurdjieff's philosophy, and they hung out together drinking tea and discussing Russian politics. So there's this whole group there. They're the avid yogis working on themselves, and then this group. They met with others at meals and in the Turkish baths, and once in a while they took part in some of the group work projects. Fritz couldn't figure out who they were and why they were there. They were like people from Gurdjieff's personal or karmic life, you could say. And, you know, there was war and so on, so he, out of his compassion, he took them with him sometimes, you know. But it was true even in Baba's ashram. I noticed that there were lots of people around the ashram who were there for different kinds of purposes. They weren't avid seekers necessarily, but they lived in some part of the ashram and they did their own thing. Fritz writes, notable among these refugees was one man about 60 years of age by the name of Rakhmilovich. He was distinguished from the Russians, they called them the Russians, all these people, because he was inexhaustibly curious about everything that took place. He was a mournful doer type, full of prophecies of disaster, dissatisfied with everything. He complained continually about the food, the conditions in which we lived. The water was never hot enough. There was not enough fuel. The weather too cold or too hot. People were unfriendly. The world was coming to an end. In fact, anything at all, any event or any condition was something that he seemed to be able to turn into a calamity, or at least an impending disaster. So at the same time, a group of children were living at the priory, and Fritz was one of them. And they found this Rakhmilovich very comical and irritating. And they tortured him and unmercifully, as kids can do. And he obviously didn't have much of a sense of humor. And the other Russians saw this happening but didn't come to his aid because they obviously were complicit in this torture and they liked it. So now back to the lawn project. This is Fritz again. It was on the second or third day that one voice rose in protest against the whole project. They're all doing it. It was Rakhmilovich. In a towering rage, he laid down whatever implement he'd been using, marched straight up to Gurdjieff, and told him that what we were doing was insane. There are so many people working on the lawns that the new grass seed might better be thrown away than sown under their feet, because they're all killing it all. People were digging and raking aimlessly wherever they could find a vacant spot, paying no attention to what they were doing. In what seemed equal fury, Gurdjieff protested against this uncalled for criticism. He knew better than anyone in the world how to rebuild lawns. He was an expert. He was not to be criticized, and so on, ad infinitum. After several minutes of this raging argument, Rachmilevich turned on his heels and strode away. Everyone, we had all been impressed with his standing up to the master in this way, stopped their work and watched him until he disappeared into the woods beyond the furthest lawns. An hour later, Gurdjieff called Fritz to him and said it was important that he bring Mr. Rachmilevich back, and that in order for Rachmilevich to save face, he would have to send for him. He'd have to send for him because he'd never come back on his own. He told Fritz to harness the horse to a wagon. Fritz put himself in Rachmilevich's place, and he was able to find him in a distant vegetable garden. So Fritz writes, "I was not very surprised when my hunch proved to be right. He was in the garden as I hoped he might be. He was not in what I would have thought a normal, usual place, however. He was, of all things, sitting up in an apple tree. Concealing my astonishment, I really did think he was mad. I drove the horse and wagon directly underneath the tree and stated my errand." He's the kid of 12 or something. "He looked at me distantly and refused to go back. I didn't know of any arguments. I could not think of any good reasons with which to persuade him to come back." "So I said that I would wait there as long as he did, and that I could not return without him." After a long silence, during which he occasionally glared at me, he suddenly, without a word, dropped quietly into the wagon from the tree and then sat on the seat next to me as I drove back to the main house. Gets better. Later, Gurdjieff asked Fritz to tell him exactly where he'd found him. And Fritz writes, "When I told him I'd found him sitting in a tree in the far garden, he looked at me incredulous, made me repeat this, asked me if I was absolutely sure, and I assured him that he'd been in a tree and that I'd had to sit there for a long time under the tree before he'd consented to come back with me. He asked me what arguments I had used, and I confessed I had not been able to think of anything except to say that he had to come back and that I had said I would wait there for as long as he would. Gurdjieff seemed to find this whole story very amusing and thanked me profusely for telling it to him." That evening, during the salon, they had like a satsang at night, after De Hartman played music — De Hartman's one of his students who's a great musician and is playing music — Gurdjieff told everyone he had an amusing story to tell. And don't forget that Rachmilevich is there. He proceeded to reconstruct in elaborate details and with a great many new embellishments of his own the story of Rachmilevich's defiance of the afternoon, his disappearance, and my capture of him. Not only was the story highly embellished, but he also acted out all the parts himself. Rachmilevich, the interested spectators, myself, even the horse. Amusing as it was to all of us, it was more than Rachmilevich could bear. For the second time that day, he strode away from Gurdjieff after a furious outburst, vowing that he would leave the Praire forever. He had finally had enough. I do not believe that anyone took him seriously at the time, but to our surprise and consternation, he actually did leave the following day for Paris. Oh. Well, that's not the end of the story. Later, Gurdjieff goes to Paris and fetches Rachmilevich himself. And then he gives Fritz a wonderful teaching about why every ashram needs troublesome people to stir the pot. And so the next time I do Gurdjieff, I'll tell the rest of that story. That's very good, huh? Okay. So strange are the ways of these great beings. And everything they do is designed to make us grow. And growth is not always easy. Sometimes it's difficult. But if it's not amusing to us, it's amusing for others. So let's meditate. Beautiful story, isn't it? You like those stories?
Yeah, I love
that. Okay. So we'll meditate now. Everyone has a Rachmilevich inside of us. But deeper than that is the Brahman, is the self. And so in meditation, let's find that place within us. And we'll meditate for 10 minutes. And as Baba said, there's a place of great purity and great joy and great love and great peace within us. And for that, we have to let our mind become quiet. Let our mind become still. Take the mind away from thoughts of the external world and what might happen in the future, what may have happened in the past, and bring it present. Remember yourself. Remember your present experience. Be with yourself. And go deep within and find that place of nectar. And we'll meditate on the self for 10 minutes. And once again, with great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satgurunath Maharaj Ki Jai.